This tape will become part of the Scandinavian Immigrant Experience Collection at Pacific Lutheran University. The date today is July 15th, 1981. The interview is taking place in the home of Olaf Sivertsen and is being conducted by Maureen Nesvig. This is a continuation tape of the interview with Mr. Sivertsen. This is a second tape. Mr. Sivertsen, would you talk about how you came to this Mountain View area from Tacoma and how you settled the land here?
Well, I had my home in Tacoma. Had a wife and two children and had my work there. For some time I had in mind that I would like to raise my family out in the country where the air was clean and where there was lots of room. And it would be a great deal nicer to raise a family. In 1910, I bought a piece of land about 10 miles east of Tacoma on the Edgewood Hill, north of Puyallup and Sumner, at a place that is called Mountain View. The land was covered with virgin timber, just about like it was down the valley when the first pioneers came in 1850. I built a small house and moved my family out here, a boy of two and a girl only a month old. A brother-in-law and I started to fall timber, saw it up into 4-foot lengths and spread it into cordwood. We worked at that the fall that year and the following winter. In the spring, my brother-in-law went back to Tacoma to his work as a carpenter, and I bought a team of horses and hauled the cordwood down to Uvita, loaded it on flat cars and shipped it into Tacoma on the interurban.
Where did you load it to? You took it?
Took it to Tacoma. Oh. Loaded the wood down at Uvita on the interurban line between Tacoma and Seattle and shipped it into Tacoma where it was sold to the wood dealers.
Now, how did you clear? What types of equipment did you have to use in those days to get out those big trees? Was this a job you could do by yourself, or?
My brother-in-law had a 7-foot crosscut saw that we used to fall the trees. Now, the trees were mostly from 3 to 6 feet in diameter. There was one granddaddy tree on my place that was almost 8 feet across the stump, 6 feet from the ground. But that was the biggest on the place. After the cordwood was cleared out of the woods, I started to clear them. I went out to DuPont and got the load of dynamite, hauled it home and tunneled under the stumps, put enough dynamite under to blow them out of the ground or at least split them. Then I used my team to pull them out. Sometimes I had to use cables and tackles in order to get them out. Then I would pile them in great big piles and burn it.
And what was at DuPont? There was a special place to get dynamite? Or?
DuPont built the powder factory out near Nisqually, south of Stilicho. They had a powder factory there, and they manufactured stumping powder. Audinova, specially made for blasting stumps. And I would go out there with a team in my stick wagon and take 4, probably a ton of dynamite on the wagon, haul home.
Now, what was special about that dynamite? Was it extra strong for blowing out stumps?
No,
or?
It wasn't quite as strong as genuine dynamite. It was safer to handle. Mm. It was perfectly safe, unless you prepared it for blasting. You would dig a tunnel underneath of the stump into the center. Then you would place enough dynamite down in the hole to crack the stump or blow it out as you wish to do. Then you would take a cap that was specially made and attach a fuse to it and put it in one of the sticks right in the middle of the pile of dynamite under the stumps. And then you would tamp the hole solid. You could load as many stumps as you dared to load. Then you would light the fuses and you would run for a safe place out of the way for the stumps that would be flying around and the rocks. Then you would light all the fuses and the stumps would go off one after another. Then you would come back with a team and pull out the stumps and pile them up and burn them. When that was done, then you had to fill the holes and level the land, plow it, harrow it, prepare it for seed and seed it in so as to get hay for the couple cows and of course for the team of horses.
How long did this clearing of land go on? How many did you do this all right away, or was it over a period of years?
No, it took a long time. You did pretty well if you cleared an acre of land each year.
An acre a year.
Because I had to work out in order to make a living for my family and to pay the expenses for improvements. So I could clear land only when I didn't work somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
How
big a team did you have? You say a team. Was that horses?
A team of horses. There are two horses.
Two horses.
I did quite a bit of plowing in the neighborhood with my team. And after a couple of years, then I sold the team and bought a smaller horse and bought a stump puller. Then I used that rig to clear land in my spare time. It cost quite a bit to feed a big team. Then I went back to cement work for the next few years and just cleared the land as I could spare the time.
Was anyone ever hurt in that type of work, blowing out stumps? Did any accidents occur?
No one was hurt. Except I had a dog and he wanted to be right there when I loaded a stump and let it. Then he was right there and jumping around and barking and was excited and thought that was a great, he thought it was great fun to see the stump go up. One time he went right on top of the stump and stood there yapping till the stump blew up and he went up in the air, but he was a little bit sick after that and wasn't very peppy for a day or two after.
But he survived.
That was the only accident I had blasting stumps.
Did you get a very good price for all that timber that you cut up and sold?
The odd part was that the man that sold the land, he reserved the timber. We cut the timber for so much and split it into cordwood for so much cord. And I had so much cord for hauling it down to Uvita and load it on boxcars and ship it into Tacoma. So really it was his timber and I was...
So part of the deal of buying the land really was just to clear the land. So that was part of your obligation?
Of course, I bought the land, but he reserved the timber. And if I wanted to clear the land, I had to get the timber off. So we made a deal. Mm-hmm. I cut the timber into cordwood and did a work and got paid for it. And then I could clear the land. Of course, at that time, wood was rather inexpensive, so he didn't make a great deal of money on the timber, and I didn't make an awful lot splitting it and hauling it. So it was just about a 50-50 deal.
I'm wondering what life for your family was like out here when you were clearing the land in those days. You had built a house, and was it hard to get along, or what was life like, everyday life?
Well, first I built a two-room house. That was sufficient for me and my wife and my two little children at the time. But in a couple of years, then I built an addition to the house. So eventually it was a six-room house as the family grew. It was really a lot of hard work, but it was an enjoyable life out here. And I believe my family enjoyed it as well as I did. Our land was just a mile north of the Mountain View Church and the Norwegian settlement at Mountain View. And we became a part of that settlement. And they were all fine neighbors. And we were a part of the Norwegian community. Mm-hmm. So really it was like a big family out here.
Did the Norwegians, the Norwegians stuck together and helped each other?
Yes, they, it was a community that would help one another. And it was a very close-knit community. And it
did people socialize together?
The Mountain View Church, it was a small 18-by-30 church at the time. That was the center of the community. In the fall of 1910, we organized a young people society, and that was the social event of the community. We would come together twice a month and have our meetings, and we would have a little program, and we would have refreshments. We organized a choir that fall also. Mm-hmm. And we would sing at the church services, which took place once a month. And that choir is singing at the present time. There are other people in the choir, but it is the same choir. They organized a Sunday school also in the fall of 1910. And the Sunday school is still operating.
So a lot of things started in 1910 out here.
It was an active time mm-hmm. in the fall of 1910. And that carried on for over a number of years.
What was it? What did the women do? I mean, what were your wife's days like out here? You were working or clearing the land. What would be a woman's responsibility in a community like that?
Well, they had a ladies' aid organized in conjunction with the church. So that is where the ladies came together. So there were social activities. Mm-hmm. So the spare time was taken up. Now my wife had her two little children to take care of. And there were many things that she could help with. After we had some land cleared and seeded in to grass, we got a couple cows. The barn was built from poles taken out of the woods. The sides were lumber, and the roof was made out of cedar shades, split out of cedar, taken out of the woods. Then I built a small chicken house of the same material, mostly taken out of the woods. I mm-hmm. Bought an incubator and got hatching eggs. And hatched baby chicks.
You raised chickens?
I raised them under a kerosene lamp to keep them warm until they got big enough to start on their own in the chicken house. So we had chickens to take care of. Not very many, but some.
Did you sell those or?
The eggs we sold, but we didn't eat, and most of the milk we used ourselves, and later on we sold milk to the Inumclaw Creamery, mm-hmm. or rather the cream to the creamery. So there was plenty to do on the farm.
After a number of years, you started taking some journeys to Alaska.
We worked at cement work through the years up till 1960. And we took a contract to lay sidewalks in Seattle. Some of the sidewalk was around the University of Washington. The university was out in the, you might say, out in the woods at the time. It was outside of the city. We worked at cement work in Seattle during the summer and fall of 1906 and the winter of 1907. Then the First World War were going on and America got involved in it. Prices on anything you bought, material, would increase, and you bid on a job and you didn't know whether you was going to come out with a profit or not because mm-hmm. prices increased. Mm-hmm. And it was an uncertain at in the winter of 1917, a friend of mine was a foreman up in Alaska working for the Northwest Fish Company. And he came to me and asked me if I didn't want to go with him up to Alaska. And helped to put out fish traps. That was his job. So I decided I was going to quit contracting and I would try going to Alaska and see what life was up there. We left in March of 1917 and we came back in September.
Now you left your family behind here on
my
your
family was at home
here on your
on the farm
on your farm
taking care of what we had here, the chickens and the cows. So they were busy. The youngsters were getting a little bit older then, but then there were others that came along as babies.
And so you said you set out fishing. Now this was in western Alaska, you said, on the last
this
cave?
This was in Cook's Inlet.
Cook's Inlet.
In the southwestern Alaska.
Uh-huh.
In the fall when I came home, the Camp Lewis was just building. Because the United States had got into the war and soldiers were drafted, and Pierce County bought a big tract of land that was given to the government for a military camp, and the building was going on out at Camp Lewis. My brother was a cement foreman out there, and when I came home, I started to work at Fort Lewis, or Camp Lewis is what it's called there, as a cement finisher. We had the work in half of the military camp, and the work continued during the fall and the next winter, till next spring. Then the camp was finished out there and our cement work was over. It was too late to go to Alaska at the time, but then the man that we bought the land from had a lot of timber land around. He had more than 100 acres in timber. And at the time, there was a great demand for lumber. And he came to me and wanted me to help him to build a little sawmill. So a few neighbors and I and this man, his name was Murphy, built the sawmill close to my home.
Right around here somewhere.
Just to the corner over the road. And after we had the sawmill completed and the machinery installed, then we went out in the woods and felled the trees, cut them into logs, hauled them into the mill. When we had enough logs at the mill, then we would go into the mill and saw them up into lumber. And he would haul the lumber down to Uvita and ship it into Tacoma, the same as we did with the cordwood. It was a small sawmill, and we were just five or six men that was working at it.
Were most of these people Norwegians also?
They were all neighbors, right? around, and they were all Norwegians. As a matter of fact, most of the people around here were Norwegians at the time. We worked at the mill during 1918, and the winter of 1919. Then one day the superintendent and the foreman that I worked for in 1917 came from Seattle, and they wanted me to go with them up to Alaska again, this time to Skow Bay, just south of St. Petersburg in southeastern Alaska. Now, I liked to work at the sawmill. That was very close by. It was very handy. But they offered me such a good deal to go with them up to Alaska that I felt I couldn't turn it down.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the spring of 1919, I went to Alaska again. It was a free fare up there, first class ticket on the boat, and I was paid from the day I left home till the day I came home again, and the monthly pay was very good.
Now, what were you doing on this trip?
I was a jack of all trades. I could do almost anything. That's why they wanted me.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing I did was to help to make up the gear for the traps, fish traps, and set them out.
What was the method of catching? You were catching salmon?
We built traps. It was a complicated affair. They were built of pilings driven down in the bottom, two compartments, 40 by 40 feet. And then there was a lot of rigging to catch the salmon, and a long lead to lead the salmon into the traps. And my job was to help to make up the cotton webbing that we hung on the traps, and the salmon would be led into these cotton compartments, and then we would lift them and braid out the salmon.
This was when the salmon were spawning. Were they coming, going upstream, is that?
They were heading for some river,
yeah,
up the inlet.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way they would meet this lead from shore out to the trap, and then they would follow the lead into the trap compartments, and they couldn't get out. Then we would get in there with the steamboat and the scow and brail out the salmon.
Was there a tremendous number of salmon caught in those days?
It's different. Sometimes you would have, oh, say you got 1,000 salmon or something like that. There were times when you got up to 10,000 salmon in one lift. It just depended on how heavy the salmon would run. Well, after we were through with that, then the superintendent wanted me to paint his house and paper hang the inside, because he expected his wife to come up and stay over the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So then I turned to my trade as a painter. And after I got through with that, then I got a few men together and we painted the Kennedy buildings. And then it was just about time to take up the traps and store it away for the next season. Well, that was just about the size of it the first year.
Were there many other Norwegians working in the fishing industry up there in Alaska, or what kind of generally?
There were a few. Yes, there were quite a few Norwegians, and
was St. Petersburg, was St. Petersburg quite a Scandinavian settlement?
St. Petersburg is the little Norway of Alaska. As a matter of fact, it was founded by a Norwegian, Bushman. He came up there and built the fish trap and started the town.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Peter Bushman, and Petersburg is named after him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the odd part was that Peter Bushman graduated from Pacific Lutheran College in the early part of the century. So he was all familiar with Parkland. It was a nice little town, and you would come to Petersburg and you would talk Norwegian and hear that most of the people talk Norwegian up there. And of course it was a fishery town. Gillnetters lived there, and they were fishermen, and there was a cannery in Petersburg, but our cannery was a little bit south of Petersburg. Well, that was the first year. Then I came home and I started to work at the sawmill again, but I left home.
Do you think did it interrupt your family's life when you would go up to Alaska on these trips, or was it just something you took in stride?
It was just something that was taken in stride. I had to make a living for the family, and I had to make that living wherever I could get it. And the best possible deal I would naturally take. Now in 1920, I went up for the same company and for the same superintendent and the same foreman. I was really an assistant to the web foreman and a handyman that could do most anything that needed to be done. And that's why my pay was good. And next year I got still a better deal. We got out our traps. And then I was sent up on Stikeen River with a fish scow to buy fish from the gillnetters up on the river flats. So I was there for a while, buying fish for the company. Then the superintendent got into a row with the captain of one of the cannery tenders, the gas boats, and he fired him. And then he needed the captain for the gas boat, so he sent out on Stikeen River for me to come back to the cannery and take over the gas boat. So I ran the cannery tender the rest of the season.
Now what kind of work was that? You were running a, what was it you were doing? You were running?
I was captain on a gas boat.
A gas boat?
Yes. We called them cannery tenders because that's what they were. We would go out to the traps, and then we would lift the traps and take the salmon in the trap and haul it into the cannery.
So you became a skipper of a boat?
Yes. So that that was our job. So we would be running almost steady from one trap to another. Some of the traps were north of Petersburg, Jose, 10 or 20 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Other traps were south of Petersburg, or about 40 miles. So that was quite a run, forth and back. And it was really interesting because there you had to go through Wrangell Narrows, a narrow channel 28 meters long, and you had to change course 26 times through that channel. So you had to be pretty good with the watch and the logbook.
Were there ever any accidents or mishaps or big storms or trouble up there?
No, it was inland waters, mostly. Well, that was the year 1920. In 1921, well, when I came back, I started work for the at the sawmill again. Mm-hmm. That was almost a routine.
So you had a regular routine set up?
And I was busy all the time. Well, in 1921, the superintendent changed company. He went up for the Humes company up to Cook's Inlet again. But this time it was on the west side of the inlet. It was a desolate place. They called it Snug Harbor. There was nobody living on that side of the inlet. And it was about 60 miles across to Sevilovia, the east side of the inlet, where there were habitation.
Mm-hmm.
And about 6 miles to Anchorage, up at the end of Cook's Inlet. Well, we went up there, that was in 1921 in the spring. That was a hard time. And there was a depression that set in at the time after the war.
Mm-hmm.
And this company that we went up for went bankrupt. We were sent up there and we expected to get our supplies from Seattle, food and things like that. And we got a telegram from the bank, the First National Bank in Seattle that took over the company, that we couldn't expect to get any supplies sent up from Seattle because the company was bankrupt. If we wanted to use the gear in the cannery and be on our own and catch salmon and see if we could make anything out of it, we had the bank's permission to do so. In years past, or there was a clam bits not very far from the cannery, and in years past, Indians used to come there and dig clams.
Mm-hmm.
And the cannery would put up clams in the spring. Well, the Indians came this year too and dug clams, and we put up 2,000 cases of clams. We loaded the clams on the biggest cannery tender and told the men that came up to work during the fishing season that any of them that wanted to go back to Seattle had permission or could just take the boat back to Seattle, and they would be paid from the clams that we had put up. So most of the men went back to Seattle on the cannery tender. It was just 8 of us men that stayed at the cannery. Now, there was a China crew that really did the canning work in the cannery. They had a separate contract and they had a China boss. And that was a different deal, so they stayed. We got out a couple traps that was fishing, salmon traps. And we and the China crew did all the work that was to be done in the cannery. And during the summer we put up 8,000 cases of salmon. Now to begin with, we didn't have any food and we had no credit. Some of the boys shot the beer and we had meat. It was kind of tough, but it was something to eat anyway. And during the clam season, we ate clams three times a day. When the salmon started to run, we ate salmon. But then as soon as we put up a few cases of salmon, we took them up to Anchorage and got credit up there and got food. That way we made it through the season. In September we were all through and we had 8,000 cases of salmon in the cannery, ready to be shipped down to Seattle. That was our pay. The boat stopped there once a month on the west side of Cook's Inlet. When the boat came up there in September, it had a full load and couldn't take the salmon. And we couldn't go unless we took the salmon with us, because that was all we had
to show for all your work.
To show for our summer's work. So we had to stay there another month till the boat came back and could take the salmon. It was October before we came home. That was a long season. We made just enough to pay ourselves for the time it was up there. So it didn't turn out too bad. But that was the last year I went up to Alaska. I had enough of it.
You got tired of it after that year.
When I came home, I started to plant berries. Because berries had been in a good price during the war. They paid as much as 28 cents a pound for strawberries and raspberries. And some of the farmers made good money. Well, I was dreaming about a big berry farm. I started to plant berries. And in 1902, the price on berries were way down. Strawberries and raspberries were paid for at 3 cents a pound.
What year was that again? When did that happen? What year was that?
That was in 1902. I had blackberries, and I got a cent a pound for the blackberries. So I didn't make anything on the berries, and it was pretty slim picking.
I think we're just about to run out of tape on this side. We'll continue on the other side, Mr. Siebertson.
I was a member of the Washington Berry Growers at the time. That was a cooperative. They had a cannery full of berries and fruit that couldn't be sold after the war. And at the time, of course, I was clearing more land and working on the farm. But then a couple neighbors of mine and myself took a contract to fall some timber. In the meantime, Murphy had sold his mill to another group, and they were logging land farther off. So we got a contract to do some logging, fall the trees and cut them into logs. So we made a little bit that way, but it wasn't a great deal.
So you did many different things out here in this area. You told me last time that you've been active in the community and serving on various committees and boards.
Yes.
What was some of your main work in that area?
I seem to be useful in the community. And I was freely used.
What were some of the main ways you served your community?
Well, I was active in the church, of course.
Yes.
I was secretary for the church and Sunday school superintendent. We organized a telephone company. And first I was vice president of that company, and then I became president. And later on I became secretary and manager for the telephone company, and I kept that position till in the mid-50s when we sold the company.
That was the Mountain View Telephone Company, is that right?
That was the Mountain View Telephone
Company. An independent company.
As a matter of fact, the Mountain View Telephone Company was organized in 1908. And when they was looking for a name for the company, then one suggested Mountain View because of the nice view of the mountain. And that was the name that was adopted by the telephone company, and that became the name of the community. And it's been Mountain View ever since. Then I was appointed a director on the school board. That was in 1913. And I served on the school board for 9 years. And I was clerk for the school board for 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I was involved in the school.
What type of school did you have out here to start with? Was it a one-room school for all this big area, or?
It used to be the Edgewood School. There was only one school on the whole hill. And the people from Mountain View and from the Sumner Heights, they had to walk over to Edgewood, 2-3 miles to school. Well, in 1909, the people of Mountain View wanted to have a school closer by for their children.
Mm-hmm.
Their community was growing, and they petitioned the county school superintendent to form a Mountain View school district. And it was so formed in the fall of 1909. There was a school, but they had no schoolhouse. So they got permission to use that our little church. So the first year the school was conducted in the church, a one-room school. And then a schoolhouse was built. So in 1910, the Mountain View School had its own schoolhouse, a one-room schoolhouse, and one teacher. Her name was Mrs. Sheridan. She lived in Sumner. As a matter of fact, she was a Norwegian too. And for a while, she was secretary for the Young People Society.
Was school conducted in English or in Norwegian?
Oh, no, it was in English.
It was all in English.
Oh, yes. Some of the children didn't know English when they started the school, but of course they learned fast. My oldest boy couldn't speak English when he started the school. But then, after he learned to speak English at school, the next one went to school and they started to speak English among themselves. And we spoke Norwegian at home for some time, but eventually, when the children grew up, we turned mostly to English.
But in your children's younger days, it was a Norwegian-speaking home.
Yes.
Although you could all speak English.
Mm-hmm.
let's get the list of your children, just for the record, Mr. Sievertsen. May I have your children's names? Your oldest was a boy, was that right?
Sigvard was the oldest boy. He was born in 1908.
How do you spell his name?
Sigvard. I'm a poor speller out loud.
So Sigvard.
I can write,
uh-huh.
But I still have a hangover from Norway.
And after
and
Sigvard?
Magda was the next one. Magda,
uh-huh.
She was born in 1910 in Takuma,
mm-hmm.
And was a little baby when they moved out here. The next one was Arthur. He was born in 1912.
What was his name?
Arthur.
Arthur, uh-huh.
And he was born at home, out here.
Out here?
In the woods.
Was that an ordeal for a woman, or did she have a midwife come to help her? What was childbirth like?
My mother was a midwife,
mm-hmm.
And she was the assistant. As a matter of fact,
your mother lived in Takuma, didn't she?
My mother lived in Takuma.
Yeah.
But later she moved out here too.
Oh, she did. Uh-huh. And she had immigrated from Norway too.
She came here in 1940 with them, but two sisters.
That's right.
Brother.
So you had three children.
Bernice was the next one. She was born in 1915.
Uh-huh.
Now in 1917, we got surprised with a set of twins.
Twins? What were their names?
I was up in Cox Inlet when I got the letter from my wife. She told me that I had a set of twins at home. Their name was Olive and Helen.
Olive and Helen, two girls?
Two girls.
Uh-huh.
Then in 1920, we had another girl, Esther. And she was the baby of the family.
Mm-hmm.
That made seven. So it was quite a family.
What did the kids do during their years growing up out here? Would they have to help out around the farm? Did they have lots of chores to do?
They were all busy. And during the berry season, they would pick berries. And they would help to do whatever chores they could around the farm.
Mm-hmm.
So the family was busy. There was no idleness. Now
did all of your children stay living in this general area throughout their lives?
No, they are all scattered. But before we come to that, we better pick up where we left off.
Okay.
In 1922.
All right.
There was an election, and a new county commissioner was elected. I had been in cement work and street work and was familiar with road work.
Yes.
So I was appointed a road foreman for the district out here by the county commissioner. From that time I started to work for the county, and I continued with the county for the next 10 years. In 1908, a new commissioner was elected, and at that time I was appointed a county road supervisor for the whole district.
Now, what year was that, 1928, you say?
Yes. I worked for the county from 1923 to 28 as a foreman.
Yes.
And then I was appointed supervisor for all the road work in the district. And I had charge of that work until the next county election in 1902. His term was up in 1933, and he was defeated in the election, and of course that terminated my work for the county also.
Because yours was an appointed position, is that?
It was an appointed position. Then I decided I was going to stay on the farm. In the meantime, I had started to build, I tore down the old barn and built a new one. And I tore down the old chicken houses and started to build new and modern chicken houses. And I continued to build from 1926 till the time I quit the county. Then I had chicken houses and a flock of chickens of about 2,500. It was sufficient to stay on the farm and take care of the chickens and the cows. And from then on, I was a full-time farmer.
Did you have a certain, that seems like a lot of chickens, did you have a certain name for your business? Were you?
I joined the Washington Co-op Ag Association.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a member of that. I'm still a member of that after more than 50 years. I joined in 1926 and was an active member and also active in the organization of that concern. I also became a director in the Washington Packers Berry Association, and I served there till in the late 40s when I quit raising berries. I also became a director in the water company, of which I served as president for most of the time.
Why do you think you were so active in community affairs, Mr. Sievertson? Did you did people come to you, or did you volunteer? How was this important in your life?
Well, one thing led to another. I was fairly good at writing and figuring. I was an administrator and had been active in many things,
yes.
Could do almost anything. It seems like I was picked to do many different things and to serve in many different offices because I was able to do it. And in a way I was willing to help the community in any way that I possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, it wasn't anything that I exactly was looking for, but it just came my way. It seemed like almost automatically.
Now, if we could, I'd like to. So, were you a farmer then until you retired, more or less, here with chickens and berries?
yes, but the berries was a lot of work. I had 5 acres of berries. There was a lot of work to it and very little money in it, a small profit. So I tapered off and eventually went out of the berry business. That was the time when I went also out as director of the Washington Packers.
Mm-hmm.
And concentrated on the chicken business. And I was considered one of the good chicken farmers.
You sold chickens and eggs?
I sold eggs. That was the main
thing.
Just
eggs. You didn't sell the chickens themselves as fryers or anything?
No. In the winter, I would buy 2,000 baby chicks, sexed baby chicks, all female. The males were destroyed. So we raised only laying birds.
Mm-hmm.
Then we would raise them till 5 months old. Then they would start to lay eggs. Then we would sell the old birds and replace them with a new batch that we had just raised, which was about 2,500. Most of the time I had a hired man working at the on the place with
mm-hmm.
me, because it was a little bit more than I could take care of, plus the many different things that I had to take care of on the outside. When the Second World War started, my hired man, he was a young fellow, but very good and big and husky. He must have weighed something like 220 pounds, and he was in the first draft, so I lost him. He said he never went across the Pacific. He said he was so heavy that he took the place of 2 soldiers that he kept him down in San Francisco. as a supply manager.
Do you remember his name?
Yeah, his name was Jan Funk.
He was not Norwegian?
No. No, as a matter of fact. Well, yes, I had one Norwegian working for me, but all the rest were young Americans. Well, when I lost him, I wasn't able to get any good hired men after that, so I just cut down the flock to just about half where I could take care of them myself. In 1941, Sigurd, he was living in Tacoma at the time,
mm-hmm.
he was married. He was going to join the army. And when he had his medical examination, then they found that his lungs were affected. So he was rejected. they thought it was TB. But there was no TB reaction, so it was a person. He was a machinist. And he figured if he lived out in the country, it would be better for his health. And he liked to go into chicken business the same as I did. And I offered him to be a partner in my chicken business so as to learn the ropes. So he came out, he had 5 acres next to mine.
Did he buy the acres from you?
No, he had bought 5 acres from my mother a long time ago.
Okay.
So he came out and built his first house, and he went into partner with me for 1 year. Then he wanted to be on his own. Then I sold him half of the chicken houses. And I just kept enough to keep busy.
Mm-hmm.
And he really became the chicken farmer. And he was very successful with it. He built up a good chicken business, and he had as many as 10,000 layers.
Now some of these chicken, you still have some chicken houses out here next to your property, don't you?
Yes, they're all here.
Some of those are the ones that you built, or that?
I built all of them.
You built those.
But then I sold them to Sig. I just kept a row of houses back of the barn for myself. So he was the big chicken farmer at the time. Later on, he started to raise pullets for layers for others. And he had 2 batches a year of 20,000 birds at the time. So he was one of the good-sized chicken farmers at the time. Well,
so when did you actively, when did you really retire then, Mr. Sievertson?
I kept on until 1956.
Mm-hmm.
I was 72 years old then.
Uh-huh.
And I figured I had worked long enough. So I sold out the cows and the chickens, everything in the place, and retired. That is about the size of my farming experience.
But you've stayed here on the same land all the time.
This has been my home since 1910.
Yes.
It's a different house. In 1950, I moved the old house that I built part of it. I built in 1910 when I first came out.
Uh-huh.
I moved it over on 49th. And I lived in it while I built this house, on the same place as the old house did. Because here was a little knoll, and it was a nice building site. So in 1950, I built this house.
Yes.
My wife and I was getting, you might say, up in years, and we liked to have it a little bit more comfortable.
Yes.
The other one was a two-story building. This was on one floor. And it was well insulated and comfortable for two people that
yes.
was getting up in years.
Now, and then when did your wife die? Was that?
After I retired, we...
How many years ago was that?
That was in 1956. We traveled around a little bit, not very far, drove around, saw most of Washington, went over to Montana, to Yellowstone Park, and a daughter of ours lived down in California, so we generally took a trip down to California each year.
Now, you did tell me before on the other tape that you never did return to Norway. Is that correct?
That's right.
You never did.
I was too busy.
Yes. Now, did any of your children ever go to Norway to discover or to see what Norway was all about?
Yes. One of the twins, Helen, and her husband, took a 4 months vacation over in Europe some 4 years ago. Then they also went to Norway. But somehow they wasn't able to make connections and get to the place where I was born. Mm. And it was a disappointment.
Uh-huh.
It was a foul up of the travel bureau.
Oh.
And a grandson of mine went to Norway a couple of years ago and visited my family.
Whose son is he?
He's Olive's.
Olive's son.
Son.
But he did go to the place where you were born.
Oh, yes. Yes, and
what's his name?
His name is Carl.
Carl?
Entenmann.
Entenmann?
Entenmann. Olive married, well, he was born in Germany, but his family came to America while he was a young boy.
Uh-huh.
And they live in Seattle. Olive was a nurse. All of the children had some kind of profession. Three of them became teachers and graduated from, two became teachers and graduated from Pacific Lutheran College. And Magda, she also graduated, but she took a business course.
Yes.
And Olive was a registered nurse. And a lot of my in-laws, that's my son's wives.
Yes.
Are teachers, and I graduated from Pacific Lutheran. So we have a whole pack of the family that have attended Pacific Lutheran.
Yes.
So it is almost our own institution.
So you. And you have quite a few teachers in your family and an interest in learning and so on. And I'd like now, before the tape runs out, to talk a little bit about your interest in writing, if we might. Now, I know you've written a history of Washington State. How did that come about, or what led you to do that?
Well, my writing started long before that. It started back more than 25 years.
Uh-huh.
When we get new ministers, they generally came to me because I've been secretary for such a long time to get the information about the past history of the congregation. I come to think of it, when I was gone, then all this information would be lost. So I started to compile the history of Mountain View Congregation from the beginning. Compiled all the records, copied all the legal documents, and assembled it in one volume. That was my first writing attempt.
Yes.
And it, the volume is up in the church. So it is available to anyone that wants.
Is there more than one volume of that book?
Well, I wrote two volumes, but I compiled it in one volume.
Okay. And
you used to have your paper that I could type on both sides.
Is there more than one copy of that, I mean, really?
No, there is just the copy that
you typed
I
yourself.
Have, and the copy up in the church.
So there are two.
But the history of the congregation, I wrote the history to the 50th anniversary.
Yeah.
And I wrote another one to the 75th anniversary. So that there are many copies of them floating around.
I see.
Then I got interested in family history. And some 20 years ago, I started to write a family history and a family register. Oh, here's some 3-4 years ago. I brought it up to date because there were quite a few additions to the family in the third and fourth generation.
Yes.
So I brought it up to date and also got information about my family in Norway. I got a brother. I had a brother in Norway, and he had 4 children. And we have been corresponding regularly since.
Is that your brother, the author, Sigurd Sivertsen?
Sigurd Sivertsen,
yes.
Yes. And his daughter, Dagmar, she got a lot of information about our family going back to the 1500s. And she sent me all this information, and he incorporated that in my family history. So I have a family history.
Yes.
Then I've always been interested in early history. A year or so ago, I began to write the history of early Washington.
And you have finished that book?
And that includes the early immigrants that came to the state and the Hudson Bay Company.
Uh-huh.
The beginning of Olympia and Steilacoom, the oldest.
Now this is just, you did research. You compiled all this information from various sources?
I have a lot of clippings that I've saved through the years.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought all most of the books that I could come over that dealt with early Washington history. And reading these books, I just compiled them into a very short form, as short as I could make it.
Mm-hmm.
And get as much into it as I could. And I wrote about the early history of Seattle and Tacoma and of Puyallup and Sumter.
Now that's part of your Washington state history.
That is part of the state
history. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And of Puyallup and Sumter. And I even wrote a little history of the Edgewood community. I finished that in 1980. Then I didn't have anything else to do, so I started to write the history of it Parkland and Pacific Lutheran College.
Uh-huh.
I've written the history. I'm just on the last pages of rewriting it for Xerox copy, because the children and grandchildren and my family in Norway, they're anxious to get anything that I write. So I make copies, so the family have a copy. It isn't for publication, it's just
for your family.
For the family, and I wrote it for my own, you might call it pastime,
uh-huh.
My own enjoyment. That is just about the size of my writing. I have a couple, three pages left of the Pacific Lutheran College and University history. But I'm true that I really don't know what I'm going to start with. But
so you're
I leave that up to the future.
Okay. After you know so much about the history of this area, and you've seen this Mountain View Edgewood area grow up since 1910, or really even before, what do you have any special thoughts or feelings about this area? What does this area mean to you?
It means a lot. It's a beautiful area. It's a beautiful community, a good community,
mm-hmm.
and a community that is unique. It used to be a very close-knit community, and I would say it still is. Now, the church started out with six families and a minister. It has grown during the years. We have now over 1,200 members in the congregation. It's really one of the big congregations, and it reflects the community. It is the one big central heart or the community.
In a way, that's the same as it was way back in the early days, the center, you said.
It has really continued to be. And I think the church is the reason for this community to be what it is. A good, peaceful community.
You think it's peaceful here? Is that one of the ways you'd describe it?
Yes, I will describe it as peaceful. Occasionally we have somebody come in here, but they come from the outside, and we have break-ins, but that can't be laid to the community. That is something that is drifting in from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Our Sunday school have helped to bring up good Christian people, and that reflects on the community as a whole, even if there's only part of the community that belong to our church, but there are other churches.
Mm-hmm. What, now exactly how much you live on, you have 1 acre of your original farm left here, or?
I have 10 acres, but after I retired, I sold out and building sites. So now I have only 1 acre left with the house.
Mm-hmm.
And that is sufficient to take care of.
It's still quite a big piece of property for these days. And you told me last time that you've mowed the lawn yourself now?
I still take care of my lawn and try to keep the place neat and clean. Take care of my house. Do my own housekeeping.
You do this alone, by on your own still.
I do this by myself. My wife took sick in around 1960, and she never got well again after she passed away in late March of 1963.
Uh-huh. When you look around your property here, your acre, and you see this land now that looks like it's well, very well cleared, much different than it must have looked in 1910. Do you ever think back to those days and what it was like and how it's changed?
I often do. And I often remember when a person gets old, then he looked back and remembered. He can remember from way back better than what happened yesterday. I often think back. That is probably why I'm so interested in early history. And I like to occupy myself with what happened a long time ago, because it is so interesting. It brings back the time when the whole country around here was just wild timberland, mostly, with wild animals and Indians roaming the trails. And then follow the first immigrants that came out here, the first homesteader down in the Puyallup Valley. And as the others came in and took land, cleared, made homes, built towns, and made it what it is at the present time, it is very interesting. It's fascinating.
Do you have a feeling, Mr. Siebertson, that you are a part of this history that you're so interested in?
Yes, I feel I'm part of it. Because I started out here just like the pioneers did, out in the wild timbers, and cleared a little spot, put down a cabin, and kept on clearing and developing, and helped to make a community. Yes, I'm part of the land, part of the history. And I feel very close to the development of this part of the country.
Well, with that, I think we'll stop the tape and say thank you very much for
You're welcome.
Part two of your interview.